I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, an update on the status of the consent decree agreed to by the Department of Justice and the Baltimore City Police following an investigation by the DOJ that concluded that serious violations of constitutional rights occur with alarming frequency on the streets of our city. Last week, the judge appointed to implement the provisions of the decree convened a hearing to decide whether or not it's viable. He needs to sign it to put it into effect. My guests are Kevin Rector, who has been following this story for the Baltimore Sun, Ganesha Martin, who heads up the Baltimore Police Department of Justice, Compliance, and Accountability, and Ray Kelly, a community organizer and co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. The community and the consent decree, making police more accountable. Next on Midday. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us on this second beautiful, balmy spring day in the middle of February. It's supposed to snow tonight, but for the moment, we'll take what we got. When the Department of Justice issued its report on the findings of their investigation into the Baltimore City Police Department last summer, it stated unequivocally that the police department engages in a pattern or practice of conduct that violates the Constitution or federal law. What followed after that report was a series of negotiations between the DOJ and city police that resulted in a consent decree that outlined the ways in which the police could address the problems identified in the report. The consent decree was announced on January 12th, just a week before the Trump administration assumed power. It called for, among other things, the creation of a community oversight task force, new procedures for stops, searches, and arrests, new directives concerning use of force, and enhanced training for officers. A judge was appointed to approve and oversee the implementation of the consent decree. Last week, U.S. District Judge James K. Bredar held a hearing at the federal courthouse in Baltimore. Judge Bredar must sign the consent decree in order for it to be in effect. He asked the parties involved, including Mayor Catherine Pugh, about various aspects of the deal to determine whether or not it's feasible. Signing the consent decree is one thing. Repairing the damage done to the relationship between citizens and the police is quite another. But the consent decree is seen by many to be an important first step in fixing the distrust that exists between the police and, in particular, communities of color here in Charm City. Today, an update on where things stand so far in this lengthy and complex process. Ganesha Martin is the chief of the Baltimore Police Department of Justice, Compliance, and Accountability. Chief Martin, welcome to the show. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Ray Kelly is a community organizer, an advocate, an activist, and the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. Ray, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Rector covers, among other things, crime and the courts for the Baltimore Sun. Kevin, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
We invited the Department of Justice to participate in our conversation today. They declined that invitation. We also reached out several times to the Fraternal Order of Police, that's the police union, and they did not respond to our request. You are welcome to join us in our conversation today about the consent decree here on Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, we're at Midday Tom Hall, although I should tell you that I'm told that the internet is a little sketchy this afternoon, so your emails and tweets may have a harder time getting through than your phone call. I'm sure you've never, ever had any problems with your computer, but believe it or not, we are having some problems with our internet today that they are working on as we speak. So, Kevin Rector, let's start with you. First of all, what happened last Wednesday, I guess it was, at the hearing that Judge Bredar called at the courthouse?
Well, it was the first hearing in the consent decree case, and it brought all of the parties together. What was interesting was that the city and the Justice Department seemed pretty much in lockstep in terms of most of the consent decree, most of the provisions therein. The judge asked both sides specific questions about some of those provisions and how they might be applied in the city, how they might contrast or come in line with established legal precedent. Everyone in the room, I think, was waiting to see if the Department of Justice under the Trump administration would take a different line as to the consent decree and whether they were prepared to move forward. The judge specifically brought that issue up, asked them if they were ready to proceed, and they said they were. So it seems as though the consent decree is moving full steam ahead at this point. The next step is likely a public input period where it seems as though there will be both written comments collected from the public and perhaps a public hearing where members of the public, community leaders, activists, et cetera, may be able to sign up to speak.
Concerning the Trump administration, on Inauguration Day, about 1:30 in the afternoon, from what I'm told from people at the Department of Justice, the administration asked for two delays in court in cases that the Department of Justice was involved in. One had to do with the voting rights case in Texas, and the other had to do with the consent decree in Baltimore. And they asked for a delay of about a month to do what? And then does that delay that they requested, does that seem to be off the table now? I mean, because it sounds like less than a month later, February 1st from January 20th, February 1st, they do appear to be moving ahead.
Well, the Justice Department had asked for a week delay, and they received
it. Okay, maybe
it was
a month delay in the voting rights case.
Then. Maybe. So they asked for a week delay on the day of President Trump's inauguration, and they said they needed that time to brief the new leadership coming into the Justice Department on what the consent decree entailed. And they said they were doing that in good faith, not as a delay tactic, but simply to have that time. So they were granted that delay, and the delay pushed the hearing that was last week back by a week. So that's why last week at the hearing, we were eagerly awaiting to see if they had indeed talked to new leadership and had come to a different point of view as to the consent decree. And also why it was important that they had not, it seemed. I talked to a former head of special litigation in the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department after the hearing last week. He said that was a very good sign that the DOJ had not changed its position for reform advocates, because that would have been the point at which, if they had a different standpoint, they should have raised
it. If they were going to change their minds, as they may do in the Texas voting rights case, according to folks at the Justice Department, they would have done it then. So, Chief Martin, does that what do you think was accomplished at the hearing, and did you feel that it was another good step forward in this process? I mean, is there comity between the police department and the Department of Justice in this regard?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the hearing did a couple of things. Number one, it showed us that we're going to have a very engaged judge. He was very thoughtful in the questions that he put forward to both of the parties. Several times during the hearing, he commented that he was surprised that there wasn't more issues and a little bit more adversarial kind of interaction between the police department and the Department of Justice. And I think, that wasn't present because Baltimore did something that no other jurisdiction has done. Within days of the police commissioner being asked to be the interim police commissioner, he asked me to set up the division of Department of Justice Compliance and Accountability and External Affairs. And generally, that's a mandate in the consent decree. So we were about a year and a half ahead of the game. And what we were able to do is look at a summary of all of the major consent decrees and the president's plan on 21st century policing and start working on things that needed to be worked on anyway, but that we knew would be addressed in the consent decree. So unlike most other consent decrees, it says in ours that the Baltimore Police Department will continue certain policies, it will continue certain programs, because we took it very seriously and started working on things that we knew the community wanted to see us work on, like use of force, our interaction with youth, and things of that nature. So it really helped us go into the negotiations very educated. We held several community meetings where we talked to community advocates and heard from them about what they wanted to see in the consent decree. DOJ did the same thing. And during the negotiations, they had become very familiar with the things that we'd already done. We asked the Department of Justice to come in because we knew that we had issues. So there wasn't a lot of disagreement on the fact that there were issues. The conversation really surrounded what are we going to do for Baltimore, for the police, so that they can do their jobs better. And for the community so they can have the police department that they deserve.
So Kevin Rector reported a week or so ago that before the hearing, the judge asked both parties to bring in some information, you know, pertaining to the cost of this and stuff like that. One of the things that he mentioned was the relationship between the consent decree and the collective bargaining agreement between the police and the city. Mm-hmm. What can you say about the collective bargaining agreement and how that plays into it at this juncture?
I can't say much because it's an active negotiation, so all of those negotiations are confidential. What I can say, and it's one of the things that the judge asked directly about, was the issue of civilians on the trial board. And that is something that both the mayor and the police commissioner have asked for. The police commissioner in the interim has opened up trial boards, you know, in trying to be more transparent and accountable to the community. But that's definitely something that both the mayor and the police commissioner are pushing for, both in the negotiations and in this legislative session. And as far as the cost goes, the mayor was very clear about her commitment to reform and paying for it. The thing that we all have to take into consideration, it's no surprise to anybody, is that we are not a resource-rich jurisdiction. And so we have to be pragmatic and we have to be practical about the things that we need to accomplish. And there's a lot of people in Baltimore, both police and community, that are relying on us to actually be able to implement things that will help them have the communities that they want and the police to do the job that they need, surrounding technology and all those sorts of things. And so the mayor was asked point blank by the judge if she would pay for it, if he asked for a Cadillac versus a Pinto, and she said absolutely. And the other thing she brought into the conversation is that she's had a lot of foundations and people reach out to her and say, I want to help. And that's the one thing that I think the consent.
She's even announced a couple already.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So she is pretty confident that the money can be found.
Yeah, and she's going to do whatever she needs to be able to find it. And I think that's the one thing that, has been good about the situation is that it's brought together foundations. It's brought together community members like Ray. It's brought together, Kevin and I. It's brought together a lot of folks that probably wouldn't normally talk to try to find solutions for Baltimore.
We have a little clip of the mayor's reaction to the consent decree following that hearing.
Training, 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 training. And we've begun some training.
I actually wasn't following the hearing. That was on January 12th when they announced the consent decree. So Ray Kelly, Chief Martin referenced community input that's taken place so far. Kevin talked about more community input happening as we go forward. With the No Boundaries Coalition, you've held a number of meetings. You've listened to folks. You've gotten input from a lot of people. You have been at the table. What are the things in the consent decree that you think are promising, and are there things not in this document that need to be? And is there a chance that those could still be added at this juncture?
So overall, I was kind of pleased with the overall consent decree, and there's a lot of language that will make our policy work going forward still most important in the efforts, but I was definitely pleased with the consent decree. I think every side had opportunity to kind of state their recommendations. Like Chief Martin said, we actually have had multiple opportunities to come to the table together to kind of discuss moving forward. And the judge's involvement in that hearing, where he definitely made sure every partner, every party involved made a commitment to moving forward with this consent decree as it was written. So we still have a lot of work to do, and we never thought the consent decree would be the silver bullet to end police brutality, but we see it as a valuable tool, and a lot of the recommendations made by our community members are actually in this consent decree, where now we focus on staying involved, like Kevin said.
And when you hear the mayor say training, 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 does that ring true to you? Do you think that that's at the core of what needs to happen?
Well, I think that's a major component, and the consent decree spells out how the civilians and communities are involved in every aspect of not only the training itself, but creating what kind of training best fits their community. So even though there's not a lot of legal language as far as policy aspects, there's a lot of opportunity for community involvement and implementation process moving forward.
Ray Kelly is the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. Kevin Rector covers crime in the city for the Baltimore Sun. Ganesha Martin is the chief of the Baltimore Police Department of Justice Compliance and Accountability. We're talking about accountability and building trust between the police and residents of Baltimore City. By the way, next week here on Midday, Mayor Catherine Pugh will be my guest on Tuesday. And the following week, on Tuesday the 21st, Baltimore City Police Commissioner Kevin Davis will join me here in Studio A. You can join us today. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Midday at WIPR.org is our email. Our Twitter handle, at Midday Tom Hall. We'll have more on the consent decree with the Baltimore City Police Department after this break. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Very glad you're with us this afternoon. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, Jamila Krempel and Bridget Armstrong make their triumphant return in Tube Talk, our conversation about what's hot and what's not on the small screen. We look forward to hearing from them and from you about what everybody is binging on these days with 500-plus channels to choose from. We could all use a little advice as to what to check out, and we'll get it tomorrow here on Midday. We'll also hear from theater critic J. Wynn Russick about Samsara. That's the new show at the Single Carrot Theater. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about the status of the consent decree between the Department of Justice and the Baltimore City Police Department following a scathing report from the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ last August. The city entered into a consent decree last month, just days before the Obama administration handed over power to the Trump team. A judge has been appointed to oversee the agreement, and today we're talking about what the next steps are with Ganesha Martin. She's the chief of the Baltimore Police Department of Justice Compliance and Accountability, Kevin Rector, who covers crime in the city for the Baltimore Sun, and Ray Kelly. He's the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. We are welcoming your calls, questions, and comments as well. 410-662 is our phone number. That's your best bet getting through because we're having some computer and internet problems. But if you want to try an email, it may make it through. Midday at WYPR.org is the email address, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. 410-662-8780. That's our number here on Midday. So, Kevin Rector, talk a little bit about the contract and the police union. I mean, when it comes to police or to community input, we do have a statement from Gene Ryan, the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, which he issued on the 12th, the day that the decree was announced. He said, despite continuing assurances by representatives of the Department of Justice that our organization would be included in the consent decree negotiations, no request to participate was ever forthcoming in the process. So he's complaining that they were basically left out of the process, and now they're in the middle of a contract negotiation.
Yes. So I think there are others who have been involved in the consent decree process who take issue with Lieutenant Ryan's claim that they weren't involved. I know that at the end of the day, there are two parties to this case. It's the DOJ and the city and the police department. And so I would assume that at some points the FOP was not in the room. Particularly when they were going through the final stages of negotiations. I know that there were some efforts to survey officers on the department to bring their input into the process. The FOP is a interesting player in this case however. In other cities with consent decrees, we've seen the Fraternal Order of Police and the local police unions try to get involved in cases, try to file motions to intervene. I don't know whether the FOP here is going to do that, but they were very much present in the room at the hearing last week anyways, in part because the judge had questions about the collective bargaining agreement, which governs the contracts of the officers who work for the department. And that interplays. We talked a little bit about training and costs earlier. All of these things are intertwined. The judge asked whether the collective bargaining agreement for the union would control and would supersede provisions in the consent decree if there was some disparity between the two. The clear answer from both the city and the DOJ was that yes, the collective bargaining agreement controls. What the Department of Justice said was that there is disparity now in those two things, the consent decree and the collective bargaining agreement, including around whether civilians can participate on trial boards, which is something that the mayor has named as a top priority, something that activists in the city want. Right now, the collective bargaining agreement precludes that from happening. Right now, the city and the FOP are locked in negotiations. The DOJ said that if that disparity exists in the new contract, then the collective bargaining agreement would hold and that remains off the table. The DOJ's representative also said if there were new disparities in the new collective bargaining agreement, then the DOJ would believe that the city was in violation of the consent decree. It gets very complicated, but the collective bargaining agreement also controls the shifts for patrol officers right now. It's a big sticking point in the negotiations for the department and the city. The FOP is reticent to give up its shift control, its shift structure where officers work 4 days a week. And the department has said already that it can't fill patrol shifts. Once the consent decree goes into effect.
And that's why we have this tremendous overtime cost every year. People are.
Right. And once the consent decree goes into effect, if it is indeed approved, there's a vast amount of training that it requires. And that will require patrol officers to be pulled off the street into classrooms so that they can receive that training. So all of this
estimates are about 80 hours per person, right?
Yeah. So
that's two full weeks of work.
I've talked to people who said it'll be an issue if the department already does not have enough officers to fill patrol shifts and suddenly has to meet the requirements of this consent decree, pulling more and more officers off the street into classrooms to do that.
And Ganesha Martin, what do you think about that? I mean, it seems that the Baltimore City Police Department is having trouble attracting candidates to work in the department. They seem to be understaffed in a lot of ways. The mayor just released some positions, and you've reassigned some people from administrative positions to street patrols. But then that, in turn, has gutted the very group of people that's supposed to be helping. It's the division called the Community Collaboration Division, you know.
Right.
So it's, you know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Yeah, you know, that it's been a problem long, you know, before now, having the right amount of police officers to patrol our streets. And I think that's one of the reasons why the consent decree is so important, because everybody has been focused so much on homicides, which rightfully so. There's so many things that have been fallen to the wayside. And it's kind of like we got to bring down that homicide rate no matter what. And that has caused the rift between our community and our police. You know, our police officers are on the streets every day with cars that are not working properly, with technology that other jurisdictions have had since the 1980s. We're the eighth largest police department with some of the toughest criminals and some of the toughest streets. And yet we don't have anything in our cars to for them to actually communicate with each other. They have to call somebody when they stop them to find out if that's a violent offender, or not. And so, I think that there's a lot of naysayers out there that like things the way they are, and they want to keep them that way. And so they keep talking about the negative things. But, you know, the consent decree calls for a staffing study. It calls for a retention and recruitment plan. The police commissioner right now has instituted, you know, some things around recruitment and background checks so we can move people through faster. And so with technology, better training, better systems, then you get efficiencies. And so we're working very hard to make sure that we can do what we know we need to do for our police officers and for our community in a way that does not compromise the crime fight. And I think that we can do it. We've proven that we're dedicated to doing that. That's why we started a year and a half ahead of the game. And because of that, we've been able to kind of plan and plot. And the other thing I'll say is that, you know, the Community Collaboration Division, they were great and they were awesome. They did a lot of work, but every officer needs to be a Community Collaborative Division officer.
That's Ganesha Martin. She's the chief of the Baltimore Police Department of Justice Compliance and Accountability. She's here in Studio A along with Kevin Rector, who writes about crime in the city for the Baltimore Sun, and Ray Kelly. He's the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. Ray Kelly, talk about this issue of the number of police in the force and the presence of the police in the community. You talk to some folks and they'll say, we don't have enough police officers. You talk to other folks in certain neighborhoods and say, the police are swarming all over us all the time. There's too many police officers on the streets. What do you think?
And I think that goes back to the No Boundaries report, that there are communities that are over-policed yet underserved. And for years, there's been an issue of a strong police presence as opposed to a patrol presence in communities, where you always have those people on the streets that feel like the police are too aggressive and it's too much going on when you're walking through the subway. But you also have homeowners two blocks away that want more patrols and they want that visible police presence. And I think this consent decree kind of creates rules of engagement or guidelines, so to speak, on how we address this issue. I have to agree with Ganesha that all of our organizational structures' first priority right now should be doing what we can to come together to stop the violence. There's going to be a back and forth debate throughout this process, and this is a long process. So we are prepared to call each other to task, both residents and police department. But right now, I think it's important that we come together and actually make it a possibility to implement this consent decree.
Kevin Rector, you wrote a piece about the difficulty of addressing this incredible surge in violent crime, particularly in homicides, that the city is experiencing, and implementing the provisions of the consent decree at the same time. We are at an official count of 40 homicides this year, and we're just in the first week of February. Chicago, which has been getting an awful lot of national attention, international attention, for the tremendous number of shootings. If you take the shootings per 100,000 people, which people call the rate, the murder rate, the Chicago rate is virtually half what it is here in Baltimore. It's 26.6% estimated for 2016, and here in Baltimore, almost 50%, which is actually down from 55% in 2015. I mean, the rate of people being in danger, just being out on the street in this town, is extremely high. Higher than many places in the country. In New York, it's 4.2%. Boston, the city that's about the same size, it's 7.3%. I mean, it's just tremendously lower. And of course, these are people in certain neighborhoods. So what are the folks at the police department telling you about their capacity to address this incredible violence, the rate of violence, and improve community policing, community relations?
Police Commissioner Davis told me for the story that I wrote that it's not an issue of A or B. Can we reform or can we get control of the homicide rate? It's an all of the above. He said it would be too easy to say that we can't do both at the same time. But to your point, we are seeing historic violence in the city. We're at more than a homicide a day so far this year. 2015, we had a per capita high on record in the city. Last year was the second highest per capita on record. There are some difficulties in comparing cities. I think Ray might agree that in some of these neighborhoods, it is profoundly affecting the lives of everyone there because it is intense. In other neighborhoods in Baltimore, it is not. It's difficult to compare city sizes because some cities within their boundaries include what we might consider the suburban areas in Baltimore County. So the comparisons are difficult. It is true that Baltimore's violence is extremely high at the point we are today. I think it's an important thing to note as well that many folks in the city take issue with the claim that the police department is underfunded or somehow does not have enough officers. Certainly, we've discussed already the fact that the police commissioner said he did not have enough officers to fill patrol shifts, but others would point to the $480 million a year annual budget that the police department already has, the fact that it consistently blows through that budget and spends millions of dollars more each year on overtime, and the fact that it has the eighth largest police department in the country, despite it's not being in the top 20 largest cities in the country. There is a definite intention within the consent decree to address the police department, its resources, and whether or not it's right-sized for the city. And I think that that takes an investment on the front end. I think that other cities have seen efficiencies when they have gone through that process and gone through these staffing studies. And it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out in Baltimore and what it determines should be the prescription for both the size of the police department, the budget of the police department, and how many officers we see out in these neighborhoods, and how people who think there are already too many officers and people who think there aren't enough feel about it.
That's Kevin Rector of the Baltimore Sun. He's here with Ray Kelly of the No Boundaries Coalition and Ganesha Martin of the Baltimore City Police Department. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Chief Martin, can, for example, again, the head of the FOP, Gene Ryan, has gone so far as to suggest that certain tenets in this consent decree are unconstitutional. He says that it ties the hands of police. It gives an undue burden on police officers who are facing great danger on the streets of Baltimore day in and day out, and it just makes their job considerably harder. If there is, as the DOJ report indicates, this culture, a fairly deep-seated culture of treating citizens in a fairly consistently unconstitutional way, can that be changed with a contract? Can that be changed through training? I mean, how does one shift a culture of an organization that, according to the DOJ, is, you know, deeply flawed?
So the first thing I want to point out is that the DOJ report covered 2010 to 2016, and it did not delineate some of the things that they were reporting when it was happening. So one of the things that, you know, that's really important to the police commissioner and I is there's issues that we recognize that we can attack and deal with, but the report doesn't really delineate. So we have to get better at our capturing our data. The body cameras have helped us with that. So we have to really understand what, you know, is actually going on the ground now. I think that there's, you know, two categories of officers, if you will. One, where, you know, if they're mistreating our community, if they're being disrespectful, if they're policing unconstitutionally, then those are folks that should not have a gun and badge. They should not be interacting with our citizens. But there are a large group of police officers who have not had the appropriate training that they needed. They have not had the technology. They have not had the supervision, the management that they need to be clear and the things that they're supposed to be doing on the street. So to your point and the quote that you gave about Gene, the part of what the judge asked last...
Gene Ryan from the FOP.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Part of what the judge asked about last week was clarifying some of the things in the consent decree about stops, searches, and seizures. And so if the judge was asking questions, then I think there was confusion there and probably... Gene was a bit confused about whether, you know, it's unconstitutional or not. And so one of the things that we are emphasizing is the training that we're going to give to police officers. So we're adding more scenario-based training. A lot of times, I went to law school. Constitutional law can be very confusing. So it's incumbent upon us as the administration to make sure that we teach our officers the way that they are supposed to interact with our citizens so that they can both fight crime and be safe. And there is, I can guarantee you that everybody from the police department sitting across from the DOJ did everything to make sure that what we're doing is giving the police officers what they need to do the jobs that we ask them to do and not taking anything away from them.
Ganesha Martin, she's the chief of the Baltimore Police Department of Justice Compliance and Accountability. Kevin Rector covers crime in the city for The Sun. And Ray Kelly is the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. When we come back from a quick break, more on the consent decree designed to improve the relationship between Baltimore City residents and the police. You can join us. 410-662-8780 is the number to call here for Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back to Midday on 88.1 WIPR. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the status of the consent decree between the Department of Justice and the Police Department of Baltimore City. My guests are Kevin Rector of the Baltimore Sun, Ray Kelly, the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore, and Ganesha Martin, the chief of the Baltimore Police Department of Justice Compliance and Accountability. You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Before we go to the phones, Kevin Rector, the judge asked the parties after the hearing last week to come into private chambers and discuss this issue of further community input. What was that conversation about?
The judge had questions about whether he should or could hear from the public in the court case. He said, look, we're in a lawsuit here. If I allow the public to comment, do they suddenly have standing in the case, or is it sort of an informal comment period? And both the city and the DOJ said they would not have standing in the case. It would be informal. And both said they would recommend that the judge do hear from the community. The judge seemed to indicate that he was in favor of doing that. He said he'd like to take both written comments and have a public hearing to hear directly from folks. And they went into his chambers after the hearing privately to discuss the mechanism for how that might work. He said, you know, he wants to have a public hearing, but it's not going to be an open mic situation. So I think they're looking to work out the method by which they take that input.
Mm-hmm. So Ray Kelly, that's got to give you some cause for optimism. I mean, even though there's no legal standing from people in the community, because this is a lawsuit between two very distinct parties, the city and Department of Justice, they're worried about the mechanism. What mechanism would you suggest?
Well, I agree that we aren't part of those negotiations, but I think it's important that the residents and the community gets to state for the records their opposition or support of the consent decree, just so they could have that sense of transparency and feel empowered that they were a part of that process. So hopefully there will be both of those hearings where we could have written testimony submitted as well as community voices actually speaking on how they want this consent decree to
and,
move
and
forward.
It's important for the community to be able to speak directly to the judge, right?
Without,
that's what this
without
is about.
A doubt. And that gives a sense
either
of
by
involvement.
In writing or in person.
Right.
So, yeah.
Even though we aren't party, we want to remain involved through the whole process. Mm-hmm. And this helps us do that.
And Chief Martin, before we go to the phones, there's the judge in this case, Judge Bredar. Mm-hmm. And then the judge, I guess, is going to appoint a person specifically charged with implementing this, right? So the judge himself isn't going to do this, but there's a budget of a whole lot of dough. I mean, $1.475 million
right.
for someone, a court-appointed person to oversee. How's that going to work?
Right. So, you know, we were very thoughtful and in trying to make sure that the process was open, transparent to the public, both for the public hearing and the monitoring process. So after the public hearing and the judge signs the consent decree, then we will put out what's called an RFA, request for application, out to the public, and people will then apply, teams normally will apply to actually be the monitoring team for the police department. We will have a opportunity, most likely via the internet, for all of the candidates' information and qualifications to be displayed, and the community can submit comments. And then after that, there'll be interviews of those candidates. Very shortly after that, both the Department of Justice and the BPD will determine a finalist. And those finalists will then also be put forth before the community to ask for them to be able to ask questions directly to those folks, the finalists. And then what will happen is we'll submit those finalists to the judge. The judge will determine if he approves. He did reserve the right to send us back to the drawing board because this person is going to be an agent of the judge.
The judge picks.
The judge has the ultimate say-so. Absolutely. Yes.
It's midday, 410-662-8780. I'm Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. Wendell in Catonsville, thanks for calling midday. Welcome to the show.
My question is, are there bills down? Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
The General Assembly is currently in session, and I wonder if there's some bills down there that that Ray Kelly and other folks would find helpful if we could support.
All right. Thanks for your call, Wendell. I mean, there are a number of criminal justice bills floating around the General Assembly as we speak.
And there are. So I don't have any bill numbers in front of me, but we do have a law enforcement reform package that we support. It's kind of a mirror of last year's reform package. We're also pushing hard for the voting civilians on the trial boards. So we know that bill will be introduced. And I don't know, we are going to stay focused on the law enforcement reform package and work the consent decree as it comes into play. So we've been pushing for reforms in Annapolis for years. We still know that there are provisions in the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights that kind of hinder implementation of the consent decree. So we want to make sure we focus on those type issues. And you could actually go to our website and see our legislative package for this year.
Kevin Rector, maybe you can enlighten us about this, or perhaps Ganesha Ray can. When it comes to this issue of civilians serving on the review board, is that a matter of state law? Is that a matter of city ordinance? Is that a matter of a DOJ federal command? How does that work?
It's a matter of state law. The state has essentially created a structure by which individual jurisdictions can put civilians on trial boards if the FOP agrees to that. So the provision precluding it in the collective bargaining agreement of the FOP in Baltimore is what stands in the way of civilians being on trial boards here in the city.
Is there any chance, Ganesha Martin, that the FOP is going to say, yeah, that's a good idea to have civilians on the review boards? Is there anyone in the world who thinks that that's going to happen?
We hope so. I mean, we've heard their concerns. and understand them. And I hope that through the negotiations process, we can come together on the issue.
The city has two big asks right now. It's in negotiation contracts with the FOP. It has two big asks. One, it wants to change the shift structure, and two, it wants to put civilians on trial boards. So I'm interested to see how those negotiations end, because, as you know, when you want something at a negotiation table, you often have to give something. So we'll see what the city gives if it does indeed get those.
Let's go to the phones. Jason in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Ganesha Martin, Ray Kelly, and Kevin Rector.
Hi. I have two points I just wanted to make quickly. I believe that the rising crime in Baltimore is a direct response to this gang activity that has formed in these communities, almost as a byproduct of not having police officers protecting and serving the neighborhoods. And what I believe has happened is that this subculture has been created where there's this lack of trust with even communicating with the police officers, and now the gangs have taken over. And when you do see the police officers, that it may be, one may say that it's over-policing. The police officers are not actually policing in the proper way that I've seen in other major cities. And what I mean is that, you know, the lack of professionalism, when you watch a police officer, you know, maybe four or five police officers drive up one-way streets and endanger the public, you know, or you speak to them, you're in a neighborhood, you're a good guy, you speak to them and they look at you like, why are you talking to me? And so I'm very doubtful that this program that's being worked on now is actually going to resolve the problem, because the issue, I believe, is that they need to be trained properly, which I understand that's something that you guys are trying to work on, but then there's a different level of having people, just good people who, and I'm not saying they are all bad, but just having good people who can understand that they are there to protect and serve.
Sure. Jason, you know, Ray Kelly, Jason speaks on behalf of an awful lot of folks who've had that direct experience.
And I agree with Jason and premise, but we also, we don't call for more police in our communities. We are kind of asking for more effective policing in our communities. We don't really want to go through a zero tolerance street sweeping and occupations of our neighborhood, but we know that there's no community group that can do this by themselves. The police department can't do this by themselves. Safe streets. It takes all of us when we're having a murder a day. And
Kevin Rector, before we finish, we got to run. Is there any chance that the judge isn't going to sign this?
That's his prerogative, and I would suspect that he may have some tweaks to the plan. But from everyone I've talked to with experience,
most likely
in these
this is going to happen.
It's likely.
All right. Well, thanks to all of you for coming in. I really very much appreciate it, and we will stay in touch with you to keep on top of this. Appreciate it. Ganesha Martin is the chief of the Baltimore Police Department of Justice Compliance and Accountability. Kevin Rector is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Ray Kelly is a community organizer and activist and the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition of Central West Baltimore. The No Boundaries Coalition will be sponsoring a rally tonight in Triangle Park at the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and Pressman Street in West Baltimore. It starts at 6 o'clock. Representatives of the police and the state's attorney's office will join members of the community to march in solidarity against the terrible surge of violence that we are experiencing here in Baltimore in these first several weeks of the year. We've got a link to more information on that event tonight on our website, wypr.org/midday. Lunch for our guests today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Tube Talk with our TV aficionados Bridget Armstrong and Jemila Krempel. We'll talk about what's new in Tube Land. We'll dish about Lady Gaga at the Super Bowl, and we'll recommend some binge-worthy shows that you might want to consider. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have her weekly theater review. Hope to see you tomorrow here on Midday at Noon. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great day.